From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Seal of Rilye by August Derleth. My paternal grandfather, whom I never saw except in a darkened room, used to say of me to my parents, "Keep him away from the sea," as if I had some reason to fear water, when in fact I have always been drawn to it. But those born under one of the water signs, mine is Pisces, have a natural affinity for water, so much is well known. They are said to be psychic, too, but that is another matter, perhaps. At any rate, that was my grandfather's judgment. A strange man, whom I could not have described to save my soul, though that, in the light of day, is an ambiguity indeed. That was before my father was killed in an automobile accident, and afterwards it was never said in vain, for my mother kept me back in the hills, well away from the sight and sound and the smells of the sea. But what is meant to be will be. I was in college in a Midwestern city when my mother died. And the week after that, my uncle Sylvan died too, leaving everything he had to me. Him I had never seen. He was the eccentric one of the family, the queer one, the black sheep. He was known by a variety of names, and disparaged in all of them, except by my grandfather, who did not speak of him at all without sighing. I was, in fact, the last of my grandfather's direct line. There was a great uncle living somewhere in Asia. I always understood, although what he did there no one seemed to know, except that it had something to do with the sea, shipping perhaps, and so it was only natural that I should inherit my uncle Sylvan's places. For he had two, and both, as luck would have it, were on the sea. One in a Massachusetts town called Innsmouth, and the other isolated on the coast well above that town. Even after the inheritance taxes, there was enough money to make it unnecessary for me to go back to college or to do anything I had no mind to do. And the only thing I had a mind to do was that which had been forbidden me for these 22 years, to go to the sea, perhaps to buy a sailboat or a yacht, or whatever I liked. But that was not quite the way it was to be. I saw the lawyer in Boston and went on to Innsmouth. A strange town, I found it. Not friendly, though there were those who smiled when they learned who I was. Smiled with a strange, secretive air, as if they knew something they would not say of my Uncle Sylvan. Fortunately, the place at Innsmouth was the lesser of his places. It was plain that he had not occupied it much. It was a dreary, somber old mansion, and I discovered, much to my surprise, that it was the family homestead, having been built by my great-grandfather, who had been in the China trade and lived in by my grandfather for a good share of his life, and the name of Phillips was still held in a kind of awe in that town. No, it was the other place in which my Uncle Sylvan had spent most of his life. He was only 50 when he died, but he had lived much like my grandfather. He had not been seen about much, being seldom away from that darkly overgrown house which crowned the rocky bluff on the coast above Innsmouth. It was not a lovely house, not such a one as would call to the lover of beauty, but it had its own attraction, nevertheless, and I felt it at once. I thought of it as a house that belonged to the sea, for the sound of the Atlantic was always in it, and trees shut it from the land. while to the sea it was open, its wide windows looking ever east. It was not an old house, like that other, 30 years I was told, though it had been built by my uncle himself on the site of a far older house that had belonged to my great-grandfather, too. It was a house of many rooms, but of them all the great central study was the only room to remember, though all the rest of the house was one of story, rambling away from that central room. That room had the height of 2 stories, and was sunken besides, with its walls covered with books and all manner of curios, particularly outre and suggestive carvings, and sculptures, paintings, and masks, which came from many places of the world, but especially from the Polynesias, from Aztec, Maya, and Inca country, and from ancient Indian tribes in the northwest coastal areas of the North American continent. A fascinating and ever-provocative collection, which had originally been begun by my grandfather, and continued and added by my uncle Sylvan. A great handmade rug, bearing a strange octopoid design, covering the center of the floor, and all the furniture in the room was set between the walls and the center of it. Nothing at all stood on that rug. There was, above all else, a symbolization in the decor of the house. Here and there, woven into rugs, beginning with that great round rug in the center of the room, into hangings on plaques, was a design which seemed to be of a singularly perplexing seal, a round, disc-like pattern, bearing on it a crude likeness of the astronomical symbol of Aquarius, the water carrier, a likeness that might have been drawn remote ages ago, when the shape of Aquarius was not as it is today, surmounting a hauntingly indefinite suggestion of a buried city, against which, in the precise center of the disk, was imposed an indescribable figure that was at once Isathic and Saurian, simultaneously octopoid and semi-human, which, though drawn in miniature, was clearly intended to represent a colossus in someone's imagination. Finally, in letters so fine that the eye could hardly read them, the disk was ringed round with meaningless words in a language I could not read, though far down inside of me it seemed to strike a common chord. Cthulhu Rilye. That this curious design should have exercised upon me from the beginning the strongest possible attraction did not seem at all strange, though its significance did not come to me until later. Nor could I account for the unimaginably strong pull of the sea. Though I had never before set foot in this place, I had the most vivid impression of having returned home. Never in all my years had my parents taken me east. I had not before been east of Ohio, and the closest I had come to any substantial body of water had been in brief visits to Lake Michigan or Lake Huron. That this undeniable attraction existed so patently, I laid quite naturally to ancestral memory. Had not my forebears lived by the sea, on it, and besides it? For how many generations? 2 of which I knew, and perhaps more before that? They had been mariners for generations, until something happened that caused my grandfather to strike far inland and to shun the sea thereafter, and cause it to be shunned by all who came after him. I mention this now because its meaning comes clear in all that happened afterwards, which I am dedicated to setting down before I am gone to be among my own people again. The house and the sea drew me. Together they were home, and gave more meaning to that word even than the haven I had shared so fondly with my doting parents only a few years before. A strange thing, and yet stranger still. I did not think it so at the time. It seemed the most natural occurrence, and I did not question it. Of what manner of man my uncle Sylvan was, I had no way of knowing at once. I did find an early portrait of him done by an amateur photographer. It was a likeness of an unusually grave young man, surely not more than 20 to judge by his appearance, and of an aspect which, while not exactly unattractive, was doubtless repellent to many people, for he had a face which suggested something more than just the humanness of him, with his somewhat flat nose, his very wide mouth, his strangely basilisk eyes. There was no more recent photograph of him, but there were people who remembered him from the years when he still walked or drove into Innsmouth to shop, as I learned on a day I stepped into Asa Clark's store to buy my supplies for the week. "You're Phillips?" asked the aged proprietor. I admitted that I was. "Son of Sylvan?" "My uncle never married," I said. "We've had naught but his word for that," he replied. "Then you'll be Jared's son. How is he?" "Dead." The old man shook his head. "Dead too, huh? The last of that generation, then. And you?" "I'm the last of mine. The Phillipses were once high and mighty hereabouts, an old family. But you'll know it." I said I did not. I had come from the Midwest and had little knowledge of my forebears. "That's so." He gazed at me for a moment, almost in disbelief. "Well, the Phillipses go back about as far as the marshes. The two were in business long ago, together. China trade, shipped from here in Boston for the Orient, Japan, China, the islands. And they brought back..." But he stopped, and his face paled a little, and he shrugged. "Many things. Aye, many things indeed." He gave me a baffling look. "You figuring to stay hereabouts?" I told him I had inherited and moved into my uncle's place on the coast. I was now looking for servants to staff it. "You'll not find him," he said, shaking his head. "The place is too far up the coast and much disliked. If any more of the Phillipses were left..." He spread his hands helplessly. "But most of them died in 28. That time of the explosions and the fire. Still, you might find a marsh or two who'd do for you. They're still about. Not so many of them died that night." With this oblique and mystifying reference, I was not then concerned. My first thought was of someone to help me at my uncle's house. "Marsh," I repeated. "Can you name one and give me his address?" "There is one," he said thoughtfully, and then smiled as if to himself. That was how I came to meet Ada Marsh. She was 25, but there were days when she looked much younger, and other days when she looked older. I went to her home, found her, asked her to come to work for me days. She had a car of her own, even if but an old-fashioned Model T. She could drive up and back, and the prospect of working in what she called strangely Sylvan's hiding seemed to appeal to her. Indeed, she seemed almost eager to come, and promised to come that day still, if I wished her to. She was not a good-looking girl, but, like my uncle, she was strangely attractive to me. However much she may have turned others away, there was a certain charm about her wide, flat-lipped mouth, and her eyes, which were undeniably cold, seemed often very warm to me. She came the following morning, and it was plain to me that she had been in the house before, for she walked about as if she knew it. "You have been here before?" I challenged her. "The Marshes and the Phillipses are old friends," she said, and looked at me, as if I must have known. And indeed, I felt at that moment as if I did certainly know it was just as she said. "Old, old friends, as old Mr. Phillips. As the earth itself is old as the water carrier and the water." She too was strange. She had been here as a guest of Uncle Sylvan, I found out more than once. Now, without hesitation, she had come to work for me, and with such a curious smile on her lips, "As old as the water carrier and the water?" Which made me to think of the design which lay all about us. And for the first time, I now believe, thinking back upon it, implanting in me a certain feeling of uneasiness, for the second moment of it was but a few words away. "Have you heard, Mr. Phillips?" she asked then. "Heard what?" I asked. "If you had heard, you would not need to be told." But her real purpose was not to come to work for me, I soon found out. It was to have access to the house, as I learned when I came back up from the beach, ahead of schedule, and found her engrossed not in work, but in a systematic and detailed search of the great central room. I watched her for a while, how she moved books, leafed through them, how she carefully lifted the pictures on the walls, the sculptures on the shelves, looking into every place where something might be hidden. I went back and slammed the door then, so that when I walked into the study, she was not looking for something but working, quite as if she had never been at anything else. It was my impulse to speak, but I foresaw that it would not do to tip my hand. If she saw something, perhaps I could find it first. So I said nothing, and that evening, after she had gone, I took up where she had stopped, not knowing what to look for, but being able to estimate something of its size by the very fact of the places into which she had looked. Something compact, small, hardly larger than a book itself. Could it be a book? I asked myself repeatedly that night. For of course I found nothing, though I sought until midnight and gave up only when I was exhausted, satisfied that I had gone further in my search than Ada could go on the morrow, even if she had most of the day. I sat down to rest in one of the overstuffed chairs ranged close to the walls in that room, and there had my first hallucination. I call it so for want of a better, more precise word, for I was far from sleep when I heard a sound that was like nothing so much as the susurrus of some great beast breathing, and wakened in a trice, was sure that the house itself, and the rock on which it sat, and the sea lapping up the rocks below, were at one in breathing, like various parts of one great sentient being. And I felt, as I had often felt when looking at the paintings of certain contemporary artists, Dale Nichols in particular, who have seen earth and the contours of the land as representative of a great sleeping man or woman, felt as if I had rested on chest or belly or forehead of a being so vast I could not comprehend its vastness. I do not remember how long the illusion lasted. I kept thinking of Ada Marsh's question, "Have you heard?" Was it this she meant? For surely the house and the rock on which it stood were alive, and as restless as the sea that flowed away to the horizon to the east. I sat experiencing the illusion for a long time. Did the house actually tremble as if in respiration? I believed it did, and at the time I laid it to some flaw in its structure, and accounted in its strange movement and sound for the reluctance of other natives to work for me. On the third day I confronted Ada in the midst of her search. "What are you looking for, Ada?" I asked. She measured me with the utmost candor and decided that I had seen her thus before. "Your uncle was in search of something I thought maybe he had found. I too am interested in it. Perhaps you would be too if you knew. You are like us. You are one of us, of the Marshes and the Phillipses before you." "What would it be? A notebook, a diary, a journal, papers?" she shrugged. "Your uncle spoke very little of it to me, but I know. He was gone very often, long periods at a time. Where was he then? Perhaps he had reached his goal, for he never went away by road. Perhaps I can find it." She shook her head. "You know too little. You are like an outsider." "Will you tell me?" "No. Who speaks so to one too young to understand? No, Mr. Phillips, I will say nothing. You are not ready." I resented this, and I resented her. Yet I did not ask her to leave. Her attitude was a provocation and a challenge. 2 days later, I came upon that which Ada Marsh sought. My Uncle Sylvan's papers were concealed in a place where Ada Marsh had looked first, behind a shelf of curious occult books, but set into a secret recess there, which I happened to open only by clumsy chance. A journal of sorts, and many scraps and sheets of paper, covered with tiny script in what I recognized as my uncle's hand. I took them at once to my own room and locked myself in, as if I feared that at this hour, at dead of night, Ada Marsh might come for them. An absurd thing to do, for I did not only fear her, but actually was drawn to her far more than I would have dreamed I might be when first I met her. Beyond question, the discovery of the papers represented a turning point in my existence. Say that my first 22 years were static, on a waiting plane. Say that the early days at my Uncle Sylvan's coast house were a time of suspension between the earlier plane and that which was to come. The turning point came surely with my discovery, and yes, reading of the papers. But what was I to make of the first paragraph on which I gazed? Subterranean continental shelf, northernmost end at Innsmouth, stretching all the way around to vicinity Singapore, original source of Panape, suggestions in the rim, vicinity of Panape, E holds R, Innsmouth. Major writers suggested in depths. Could R occupy entire continental shelf from Innsmouth to Singapore? That was the first. The second was even more baffling. Cthulhu, who waits dreaming, and Relier is all in all and everywhere. He is in Relier at Innsmouth and at Panape. He is among the islands and in the depths. How are the deep ones related? And where did Obed and Cyrus make the first contact? Panape or one of the lesser islands? And how? On land or in the water? But my uncle's papers were not alone in that treasure trove. There were other, even more disturbing revelations. The letter, for instance, from the Reverend Jabez Lovell Phillips to some unnamed person dated over a century before, in which he wrote, "On a certain day in August of 1797, Captain Obadiah Marsh, accompanied by his first mate Cyrus Alcott Phillips, reported their ship, the Cory, lost with all hands in the Marquesas. The captain and his first mate arrived in Innsmouth Harbor in a rowboat, yet did not seem any the worse for weather or wear, despite having covered a distance of many thousands of miles in a craft deemed well nigh impossible of having carried them so far. Thereafter began in Innsmouth such a series of happenings as were to make the settlement accursed within one generation. For a strange race was born to the Marshes and the Phillipses. A blight was fallen upon their families, which followed after the appearance of women. And how came they there? Who were the wives of the captain and his first mate? And loosed upon Innsmouth, a spawn of hell that no man has found it possible to put down, and against whom all the appeals to heaven I have made no avail. What disports in the waters of Innsmouth in the late hours of darkness? Mermaids, say some. Faugh, what idiocy! Mermaids indeed! What, if not the accursed spawn of the marsh and Phillips tribes? Of this I read no more, being curiously shaken. I turned next to my uncle's journal and found the last entry. R is as I thought. Next time I shall see himself, where he lies in the depths waiting upon the day to come forth once more. But there had been no next time for Uncle Sylvan, only death. There were entries before this one, many of them clearly, my uncle wrote, of matters beyond my knowledge. He wrote of Cthulhu and Rilier, of Hastor and Yor-Igor, of Shub-Niggurath and Yog-Sothoth, of the Plateau of Leng, of the Sussex Fragments and the Necronomicon, of the Marsh Drift and the Abominable Snowmen. But most often of all, he wrote of Rilier. and of great Cthulhu, the R and the C of his papers, and of his abiding search for them, for my uncle, as was made plain in his own handwriting, was in search of these places or beings. I could hardly distinguish one from the other in the way he set down his thoughts, for his notes and his journal were written for no other eyes but his own, and he alone understood them, for I had no frame of reference upon which to draw. There was, too, a crude map, drawn by some hand before my uncle Sylvan's, for it was old and badly creased. It fascinated me, though I had no genuine understanding of its real worth. It was a rough map of the world, but not of that world I knew or had learned about in my studies, rather of a world that existed only in the imagination of him who had made the map. For deep in the heart of Asia, for instance, the mapmaker had fixed the Plateau Leng, and above this, near what ought to have been Mongolia, Kadath in the cold wastes, which was specified as in space-time continuum. And in the sea, about the Polynesias, he had indicated the marsh drift, which I gathered was a break on the ocean floor. Devil Reef off Innsmouth was indicated too, and so was Panape. These were recognizable, but the majority of place names on the fabulous map were utterly alien to me. I hid the things I had found where I was sure Ada Marsh would not think of looking for them. And I returned, late though the hour was, to the central room. And there I sought out, as if by instinct, unerringly the shelf behind which the things I had found had been concealed. There were some of the things mentioned in Uncle Sylvan's notes, the Sussex fragments, the Noptic manuscripts, the Cotes de Gules by the Comte de Herlet, the Book of Iban, Bonjun's Auspic and Colton, and many others. But alas, most of them were in Latin or Greek, which I could not read well, however ably I could struggle through French or German. Yet I found enough in those pages to fill me with wonder and terror, with horror and a strangely exhilarating excitement, as if I had realized that my Uncle Sylvan had bequeathed me not only his house and property, but his quest and the lore of eons before the time of man. For I sat reading until the morning sun invaded the room and paled the lamps I had lit, reading about the great old ones, who were first among the universes and the elder gods, who fought and vanquished the rebellious ancient ones, who were great Cthulhu, the water dweller, Hastur, who reposed at the Lake of Holly in the Hades, Yog-Sothoth, the all-in-one and one-in-all, Ithaqua, the wind-walker, your Igor, the star-treader, Cthuga, who abides in fire, great Asthoth, all of them had been vanquished and exiled to outer spaces against the coming of another day in far time, yet to come, when they could rise with their followers and once again vanquish the races of mankind, and challenge the elder gods of their minions, the deep ones of the seas and the watery places on earth, the Dholes, the abominable snowmen of Tibet, and the hidden plateau of Leng, the Shantaks, who flew from Kadath in the cold waste at the bidding of Windwalker, the Windigo, cousin of Ithaqua, of their rivalries, one and yet divided. I read all this and more, damnably more, the collection of newspaper clippings of inexplicable happenings accounted for by my Uncle Sylvan as evidence of the truth in which he believed, and in the pages of these books was more of the curious language I had found woven into the decorations of my uncle's house. Cthulhu Velye, which was translated, I read in more than one of his accounts as, "In his house at Rilye, dead Cthulhu lies dreaming." And my uncle's quest was surely nothing more than to find Rilye, the sunken, subquacious place of Cthulhu. In the cold light of day, I challenged my own conclusions. Could my Uncle Sylvan have believed in such a panoply of myths? Or was his pursuit merely the quest of a man steeped in idleness? My uncle's library consisted of many books, ranging through the world's literature, yet one considerable section of his shelving was given over completely to books on occult subjects, books of strange beliefs and even stranger facts, inexplicable to science, books on little-known religious cults, and these were supplemented by huge scrapbooks of clippings from newspapers and magazines, reading which filled me at once and the same time with a sense of premonitory dread and a flame of compulsive joy. For in these prosaically reported facts, there lay oddly convincing evidence to augment belief in the myth pattern to which my uncle had patently subscribed. After all, the pattern in itself was not new. All religious beliefs, all myth patterns, and no matter what systems of culture are basically familiar, they are predicated upon a struggle between forces of good and forces of evil. This pattern was part two of my uncle's mythos. The great old ones and the elder gods, who may, for all I could figure out, have been the same, represent of primal good, the ancient ones, primal evil. As in many cultures, the elder gods were not often named. The ancient ones were, and often, for they were still worshipped and served by followers throughout Earth and among the planetary spaces. And they were aligned not only against the elder gods, but also against one another, in a ceaseless struggle for ultimate dominion. They were, in brief, representations of elemental forces, and each had his element. Cthulhu of water, Cthuga of fire, Ithaqua of air, Hastur of interplanetary spaces, and others among them belonged to great primal forces. Shub-Niggurath, the messenger of the gods, of fertility, Yog-Sothoth, of the time-space continua, Azathoth, in a sense, the fountainhead of evil. Was this pattern, after all, not familiar? The elder gods could so easily have become the Christian Trinity. The ancient ones could, for most believers, have been altered into Sathanas and Beelzebub, Mephistopheles and Azrael, except they were coexistent, which disturbed me, though I knew that systems of belief constantly overlapped in the history of mankind. More, there was certain evidence to show that the Cthulhu myth pattern had existed not only long before the Christian mythos, but also before that of ancient China and the dawn of mankind surviving unchanged in remote areas of the earth, among the Chocho people of Tibet and the abominable snowmen of the high plateau of Asia, and a strange sea-dwelling people known as the Deep Ones, who were amphibian hybrids bred of ancient matings between humanoids and Batrachia, mutant developments of the race of man, surviving with recognizable facets in newer religious symbols, in Quetzalcoatl and others among the gods of Aztec, Mayan, and Inca religions, in the idols of Easter Island, in the ceremonial masks of the Polynesian and the Northwest Coast Indians, where the tentacle and octopoid shape, which were the marks of Cthulhu, persisted, so that, in a sense, it might be said that the Cthulhu mythos was primal. Even putting all this into the realm of theory and speculation, I was left with the tremendous amounts of clippings which my uncle had collected. These prosaic newspaper accounts served perhaps more effectively in giving pause to any doubt I might have had, because all were so palpably reportorial. For none of my uncle's clippings derived from any sensational source. All came straight from news columns or magazines offering factual material only, like the National Geographic, so that I was left asking myself certain searching questions. What did happen to Johansen and the ship Emma, if not what he himself set forth? Was any other explanation possible? And why did the U.S. government send destroyers and submarines to depth bomb the ocean about Devil Reef outside the harbor of Innsmouth? and arrest scores of Innsmouth people who were never afterwards seen again, and fire the coastal area, destroying scores of others. Why, if it were not true that strange rites were being observed by Innsmouth people who bore a hellish relationship to certain sea dwellers seen by night at Devil Reef? And what happened to Wilmarth in the mountain country of Vermont when he came too close to the truth in his search into the cults of the Ancient Ones, and to certain writers of what purported to be fiction, Lovecraft, Howard, Barlow, and what had purported to be science, like Fort, when they came too close to truth, dead, all of them, dead or missing, like Wilmarth, dead before their times, most of them, while still comparatively young men. My uncle had their books, though only Lovecraft and Fort had been extensively published in book form, and they were opened by me and read, with great perturbation than ever, for the fictions of H.P. Lovecraft had, it seemed to me, the same relation to truth as the facts, so inexplicable to science, reported by Charles Fort. If fiction, Lovecraft's tales were damnably bound to fact, even dismissing Fort's facts, the fact inherent in the myths of mankind. There were quasi-myths themselves, as was the untimely fate of their author, whose early death had already given rise to a score of legends, from among which prosaic fact was ever more and more difficult to discover. But there was time for me to delve into the secrets of my uncle's books, to read further into his notes. So much was clear. He had belief enough to have begun a search for sunken Rylai, the kingdom or the city. One could not be sure which it was, or whether indeed it ringed half the earth from the coast of Massachusetts in the Atlantic to the Polynesian Islands on the Pacific, to which Cthulhu had been banished, dead and yet not dead. Dead Cthulhu lies dreaming, as it read in more than one account, waiting, biding his time to rise and rebel again, to strike once more for dominion against the rule of the elder gods, for a world and universe of his own persuasion. For is it not true that if evil triumphs, then evil becomes the law of life, and it is good that must be fought, the rule of the majority establishing the norm, and other than that being abnormal, or, by the way of mankind, the bad, the abhorrent? My uncle had sought Rylai, and he had written disturbingly of how he had done so. He had gone down into the Atlantic's depths, from his home here on the coast, gone down off Devil Reef and beyond. But there was no mention of how he had done so. By diving equipment? Bathysphere? Of these I had found no evidence whatsoever at the house. It was on these explorations that he had gone during those periods when he had been so long missing from the house on the coast. And yet there had been no mention of any kind of craft either, nor had my uncle left any such thing in his estate. If Rylai was the object of my uncle's search, what then was Ada Marsh's? This remained to be seen, and to the end of discovering it, I allowed some of my uncle's least informative notes to lie on the library table on the following day. I managed to watch her when she came upon them, and I was left in no doubt by her reaction that this was the object of her search, the cache I had found. She had known of these papers, but how? I confronted her. Even before I had a chance to speak, she spoke. "You found them," she cried. "How did you know about them?" "I knew what he was doing."
"The search?"
She nodded.
"You can't believe," I protested.
"How can you be so stupid?" she cried angrily. "Did your parents tell you nothing? Your grandfather? How could you have been raised in darkness?"
She came close to me, thrust the papers in her hand at me, and demanded, "Let me see the rest of them." I shook my head.
"Please, they are of no use to you."
"We shall see.
Tell me then, he had begun the search?"
"Yes, but I do not know how. There is neither a diver's suit nor boat. At this she favored me with a glance which was a challenging mingling of pity and contempt. "You have not even read all he had written. You haven't read the books. Nothing. Do you know what you're standing on?"
"This rug?"
I asked wonderingly.
"No, no, the design, the pattern. It's everywhere. Don't you know why?
Because it is the great seal of Villiers. So much at least he discovered years ago, and was proud to emblazon it here. You stand on what you seek. Look further, and find his ring."
After Ada Marsh left that day, I turned once more to my uncle's papers. I did not leave them until long past midnight, but by that time I had gone through most of them cursorily, and some of them with the closest attention. I found it difficult to believe what I read. Yet clearly my uncle Sylvan had not only believed it, but seemed actually to have taken some part in it himself. He had dedicated himself early in life to the search for the sunken kingdom. He professed openly a devotion to Cthulhu, and most suggestive of all, his writings contained many times chilling hints of encounters, sometimes in the ocean depths, sometimes in the streets of legend-haunted Arkham, an ancient gambrel-roofed town which lay inland from Innsmouth, not far from the coast along the Miskatonic River, or near by Dunwich, or even Innsmouth, with men or beings which were not men, I could hardly tell which, who believed as he did and were bound in the same dark bondage to this resurgent myth from the distant past. And yet, despite my iconoclasm, there was, too, an edge of belief I could not diminish. Perhaps it was because of the strange insinuations in his notes, the half-statements, which were meant only for reference to his own knowledge, and thus never clear, for he referred to something he knew too well to set down, the insinuations about the unhallowed marriages of Obed Marsh and three others. Could there have been a Phillips among them? And the subsequent discovery of photographs of the Marsh women, Obadiah's widow, a curiously flat-faced woman, very dark of skin, with a wide, thin-lipped mouth, the younger Marshes, all of whom resembled their mother, together with odd references to their curious hopping gait, so much a characteristic of those who descended from those who came back alone from the sinking of the quarry, as Uncle Sylvan put it. What he meant to say was unmistakable. Obadiah Marsh had married in Panape a woman who was not a Polynesian, yet lived there, and belonged to a sea race which was only semi-human, and his children and his children's children had borne the stigmata of that marriage, which had in turn led to the Holocaust visited upon Innsmouth in 1928, and to the destruction of so many members of the old Innsmouth family. Though my uncle wrote in the most casual manner, there was horror behind his words, and the echo of disaster rolled out from behind the sentences and paragraphs of his writing. For those of whom he wrote were allied to the deep ones. Like them, they were amphibious creatures. Of how far the accursed taint went, he did not speculate, nor was there ever word to settle his own status in relation to them. Captain Obadiah Marsh, presumably also Cyrus Phillips and two others of the quarry's crew who had remained behind in Panape, certainly shared none of the curious traits of their wives and children. But whether the taint went beyond their children, none could say. Was it this Ada Marsh had meant when she had said to me, "You are one of us"? Or had she reference to some even darker secret? Presumably my grandfather's abhorrence of the sea was due to his knowledge of his father's deeds. He, at least, has successfully resisted the dark heritage. But my uncle's papers were, on the one hand, too diffuse to make a coherent account, and on the other too plain to enlist immediate belief. What disturbed me immediately most of all were the repeated hints that his home, this house, was a haven, a point of contact, an opening to that which lies below, and the speculations about the breeding of the house and the rocky bluff which are so often to be found in the early pages of his notes, and to which no reference whatsoever was made later on.
What he had set down was baffling and challenging, fearsome and wonderful. It filled me with awe, and at one and the same time an angry disbelief and a wild wish to believe, to know. I sought everywhere to find out, but was only baffled the more. People in Innsmouth were closed-mouthed. Some of them actually shunned me, crossed the street at my approach, and in the Italian district frankly crossed themselves as if to ward off the evil eye. No one offered any information, and even at the public library I could obtain no books or records which might help, for these, a librarian told me, had been confiscated and destroyed by government men after the fire and explosions of 1928. I sought in other places. I learned even darker secrets at Arkham and Dunwich, and in the great library of Miskatonic University, found at last the fountainhead of all books of dark lore, the half-fabled Necronomicon of the mad Arab Abdul Azared, which I was allowed to read only after the watchful eye of a librarian's assistant. It was then, 2 weeks after my discovery of my uncle's papers, that I found his ring. This was where one would least have expected to find it, and yet where it was bound to be. In a small packet of his personal belongings, returned to the house by the undertaker, and left unwrapped in his bureau drawer. The ring was of silver, a massive thing, inlaid with a milky stone which resembled pearl, but was not, and inlaid was the seal of Rillier. I examined it closely. There was nothing extraordinary about it, save its size. To look upon the wearing of it, however, carried with it unimaginable results, for I had no sooner put it on my finger than it was as if new dimensions opened up to me, or as if the old horizons were pushed back limitlessly. All my senses were made more acute. The very first thing I noticed was my awareness of the susurrus of the house and the rock, now one with the sea's slow movement, so that it was as if the house and rock were rising and falling with the movement of the water, and it seemed as if I had heard from below the house itself the rushing and retreating of water. At the same time, and perhaps even more importantly, I was aware of a psychic awakening. With the assumption of the ring, I became cognizant of the pressure of unseen forces, potent beyond the retelling, as were this house the focal point of influences beyond my comprehension. I stood, in short, as were I a magnet, to draw elemental forces from all about me, and these rushed in upon me with such impress that I felt like an island in the midst of the sea, with a raging hurricane centered upon it, a tempestuous tearing at me until I heard, almost with relief, the very real sound of a horrible, animal-like voice rising in a ghastly undulation, not from above or beside me, but from below. I tore the ring from my finger, and at once all subsided. The house and the rock returned to quiet and solitude. The winds and the waters which had moved all about me faded and died away. The voice I had heard retreated and was still. The extrasensory perception I had experienced was ended, and once more all seemed to lie waiting upon my further act. So my dead uncle's ring was a talisman and a ring of wizardry. It was the key to his knowledge and the door to other realms of being. It was by means of the ring that I discovered my uncle's way to the sea. I had long sought the path by which he went to the beach, but there was none sufficiently worn to suggest its constant use. There were paths down the rocky declivity, and some places steps had been cut long ago, so that a man could reach the water from the house on the cliff. But there was nowhere a place that might have been used for landing craft. The shore here was deep. I swam in the waters there several times, always with a wild sense of exultation, so great was my pleasure in the sea. But there were many rocks, and such beach as there was lay away from the cliff, around the coves, either to north or south, almost too great a distance to swim, unless one were a very capable swimmer, such as I learned, somewhat to my surprise, that I was. I had meant to ask Ada Marsh about the ring. It was she who had told me of its existence. But ever since that day, I had refused her access to my uncle's papers. She had stopped coming to the house. True, I had seen her lurking from time to time, or spied her car parked along the road, which led past my property, rather far to the west of the house, and so knew that she prowled the vicinity. Once I had gone into Innsmouth to look for her, but she was not at her home, and my inquiries brought me only open hostility from most of the populace, and sly meaningful glances I could not correctly interpret from others, those shambling half-derelict people who lived along the coast streets and byways. So it was not due to her help that I found my uncle's way to the sea. I had put on the ring one day, and drawn to the sea, was bent on climbing down to the water's edge when I found myself, while in the act of crossing the great central room of the house, virtually unable to leave it, so strong was its pull upon the ring. I ceased to try, presently recognizing that a psychic force was manifest, and simply stood, waiting for guidance, so that when I was impelled towards a singularly repellent work of carved wood, a primitive piece representing some hideous frog hybrid, affixed to a pedestal along one wall of the study, I yielded to impulse, went over to it, seized hold of it, and pulled and finally turned it right and left. It gave to the left. Instantly, there was a creaking of chains, a clanking of gears, and the entire section of the sturdy floor, covered by the rug, bearing the seal of Villiers, came up like a great trap door. I went wonderingly over to it, my pulse quickening with excitement, and I looked down into the pit below, a great yawning depth, into the darkness of which a continuing spiral of steps had been hewn out of the solid rock upon which the house stood. Did it lead to water below? I selected a book at random from my uncle's set of Dumas and dropped it. Then I stood listening for any sound from below. It came at last, a splash, distantly. So, with the utmost caution, I crept down the interminable stairs, down into the smell of the sea. Small wonder I had felt that the sea was in the house. Down into the dank coolness of a watery place, until I could feel the moisture on the walls and the steps underfoot. Down into the sound of restless water below, the sloshing and rushing of the sea, until I came to where the stairs ended, at the very edge of the water, in a kind of cavern that was large enough to have held the entire house in which my uncle Sylvan had lived. And I knew beyond cavil that this was my uncle's way to the sea, this and no other, though I was as mystified as ever to find, even here, no evidence of boat or diving gear, but only footprints, and seen in the light of the matches I struck, something more. The long slithered marks and the blobs where some monstrous entity had rested, marks which had made me to think with prickling scalp and goose-flesh skin of some of those hideous representations brought to the great room above me by my uncle Sylvan and others before him from the mysterious islands of Polynesia. How long I stood there I do not know, for there at the water's edge, with a ring bearing the seal of Villiers on my finger, I heard from the depths of the water below sounds of movement and life coming from a great distance indeed, from outwards, which is to say from the direction of the sea, and from below, so that I suspected the existence of some sort of passage to the sea, either immediately at hand, by means of a subaqueous cavern, or below this level, for the cavern in which I stood was ringed around, so far as I could see in the wan glow of the matches I lit, with solid rock, and the movement of the water indicated the movement of the sea, which could not have been coincidental. So the opening was outward, and I must find it without delay. I climbed back up the stairs, closed the opening once more, and hurried to my car for a journey to Boston. I returned late that night, with a diving helmet and a portable oxygen tank, ready to descend next day into the sea below the house. I removed the ring no more, and that night I dreamed great dreams of ancient lore, of cities on distant stars and magnificent spired settlements in far fabulous places of the earth, in the unknown Antarctic, high in the mountains, Tibet far beneath the surface of the sea. I dreamed that I moved among great dwellings in wonder and beauty, amidst others of my kind, and among aliens as friends, aliens whose very aspect might in waking hours have congealed the blood in my veins, all here in this nocturnal world, given to one cause, the service to those great ones whose minions were, dreamed through the nights of other worlds, other realms of being, of new sensations and incredible tentacled beings commanding our obedience and worship. Dream so that I woke next morning exhausted and yet exhilarated, as if in the night I had actually experienced my dreams and yet remained charged with unimaginable strength for greater ordeals to come. But I was on the threshold of a greater discovery. Late the next afternoon, I donned my swimming trunks, affixed a pair of flippers to my feet, put on the helmet and oxygen tanks, and descended to the water's edge below the house. Even now, I find it difficult to write of what befell me, without wonder and incredulity. I lowered myself cautiously into that water, feeling for bottom and finding it, walking outwards towards the sea, at the bottom of a cavern many times the height of a man, walked outwards until suddenly I came to its end, and there without warning, I stepped off into space and fell slowly through the water towards the ocean floor. A gray world of rocks and sand and aquatic growth that wove and writhed eerily in the dim light which penetrated that depth. Here I was sharply conscious of the water's pressure and beginning to wonder too about the weight of the helmet and the oxygen tank when the time came for me to rise again. Perhaps the need of finding some place by means of which to walk out onto the shore would preclude any further search. Yet, even as I thought this, I was impelled ever outwards, walking away from the shore and bearing south, out from Innsmouth. It dawned upon me with horrifying suddenness that I was being drawn as if by a magnet, even against my better judgment, for the oxygen in my tanks would not last long and would need to be replenished before I could hope to return, if I went very far out from the shoreline. Yet I was helpless to prevent myself from going seawards. It was as if some power beyond my control were drawing me away from the shore, outwards and down, for the land beneath the sea then sloped gently downwards, in a direction southeast of the house on the rock. In this direction I went steadily now, without pause, even though I was aware of a growing panic. I must turn about, must begin to find my way back. To swim up to the cave would require almost superhuman effort, despite the lightning pressure of the depth to start me on my way. To reach the foot of the stairs in the pit below the house, at a time when my oxygen was surely all but gone, would be almost impossible if I did not turn without delay. Yet something there would not permit me to turn. I moved ever onwards, outwards, as if by a design imposed upon me by a power greater than my own. I had no alternative. I must go ahead, and all the while my alarm grew. I found myself in violent conflict between what I wished to do and what I must do, and the oxygen in my tanks diminished with every step. Several times I vaulted upward, swimming vigorously, but while there was no difficulty about swimming, indeed I seemed to swim with almost miraculous ease, always I came back to the ocean floor, or found myself swimming outwards. Once I paused and looked about me, trying in vain to pierce the ocean's depth. I thought I imagined a great pale green fish swimming in my wake, and had the illusion that it was a mermaid, for I seemed to see hair streaming from it. But then it was lost again behind the growths of that aquatic deep. But I could not pause for long. I was drawn ever forward, until at last I knew that my oxygen was almost gone. My breathing became more and more labored, and I struggled to swim to the surface, only to find myself falling from the place to which I had vaulted upwards, falling into a crevice on the ocean's floor. Then, only a few moments before I lost consciousness, I was aware of the swift approach of my follower, of hands upon my helmet, and the oxygen tanks. It was not a fish at all, nor a mermaid. It was the naked body of Ada Marsh, I had seen with her long hair streaming out behind her, swimming with the ease and facility of a natural denizen of the deep. What followed upon this almost dreamlike vision was most incredible of all. I felt in my declining consciousness, rather than saw, that Ada took the helmet and oxygen tanks from me and dropped them into the depth below, and then slowly awareness returned. I found myself swimming, with Ada guiding me, with her strong, capable fingers, not back, not up, but still outwards. And I found myself swimming as ably as she, and like herself opening and closing my mouth as were breathing through the water. And so I was. What ancestral gift I had unwittingly possessed now opened up before me all the vast wonders of the sea. I could breathe without surfacing, an amphibian born. Ada flashed ahead of me and I followed. I was swift, but she was swifter. No more the slow walk across the ocean's floor, now only the propulsion of arms and legs that were seemingly made for the water, and the surging triumphant joy of swimming so without constraint towards some goal I knew dimly I was meant to reach. Ada led the way and I followed, while above us, beyond the water, the sun sank westwards, and the day ended. The last light withdrew down the west, and the sickle moon shone in the afterglow. And at this hour, we drove upwards towards the surface, following a line of jagged rocks which marked the wall of shore or island, I could not tell which, and broke water far from the shore at a place where a shelf of land jutted out of the sea, from which it was possible to see to the west the twinkling lights of a town, a harbor city, seeing which and looking back to where Ida Marsh and I sat in the moonlight, with boats moving shadowily between us and the shore, and I between us and the line of the horizon to the east. I knew where we were, on that same Devil Reef off Innsmouth, the place where once before, prior to that catastrophic night in 1928, our ancestors had played and disported themselves among their brethren from the ocean's deeps. "How could you have failed to know?" asked Ada patiently. "You might have died with all that to suffocate you, if I had not come to the house when I did." "I had no way of knowing," I said. "How else do you think your uncle went exploring, but like this?" My uncle Sylvan's quest was hers too, and now it was mine. To look for the seal of Relier beyond, to discover the sleeper in the depths, the dreamer whose call I had felt and answered, Great Cthulhu. It was not far off Innsmouth, of that Ada was confident. And to prove it, she led the way down into the depths once more, far down off Devil Reef, and showed me the great megalithic stone structures lying in ruin there as a result of the depth bombing of 1928. The place where many years before the early Marshes and Phillipses had continued their contact with the deep ones, down to swim among the ruins of that once great city, where I saw the first of them, and was filled with horror at the sight. The frog-like caricature of a human being that swam with greatly exaggerated movements so similar to those of a frog, and watched us with bulging eyes and frog-like mouth, boldly, not fearful, recognizing us as his brethren from outside down through the monoliths to the ocean floor once more. The destruction there was very great. Even so had other places been destroyed by little bands of willful men dedicated to preventing the return of Great Cthulhu. And so up again and back to the house on the rock where Ada had left her clothes, and to make the compact which bound us each to other, and to plan for the journey to Panape and the further search. Within 2 weeks, we were off to Panape in a chartered craft, off on that mission of which we dared breathe no word to the ship's crew, for fear they would think us mad and desert. We were confident that our quest would be successful, that somewhere in the uncharted islands of the Polynesias we would find that which we sought, and finding it, go to join forever our brethren of the seas, who serve and wait upon the day of the resurrection, when Cthulhu and Hastor and your Igor and Yog-Sothoth shall rise again and vanquish the elder gods in that titanic struggle which must come. We made Panape our headquarters. Sometimes we set out from there, sometimes we used the craft we had chartered, oblivious of the curiosity of the crew. We searched the waters, sometimes we were gone for days, and soon my metamorphosis was complete. I dare not tell you how we sustained ourselves in those journeys under the sea, of what manner of food we ate. Once there was a crash of a great airliner, but of this no more. Suffice it to say that we survived, and I found myself doing things I would have thought bestial only a year ago, that nothing but the urgency of our quest impelled us on, and nothing other concerned us, only our survival and the goal we held ever before our eyes. How shall I write of what we saw and still retain even a shred of confidence and trust? The great cities of the ocean floor, and the greatest of them all, the most ancient off the coast from Panape, where the deep ones abounded, and we could move for days among the towers and the great slabs of stone, down among the minarets and domes of that sunken city, almost lost among the aquatic forest growth of the bottom of the sea, seeing how the deep ones lived, befriended by a curious marine life which was octopoid in general appearance, and yet was not octopoid, fighting sharks and other enemies even as we are forced to do from time to time, living only to serve him whose call can be heard in the depths, though none knows where he lies, dreaming against the time of his coming again. How shall I write of our ceaseless search from city to city, from building to building, looking always for the great seal beneath which he may lie, save as an endless round of days and nights, sustained by hope and the driving urgency of the goal which loomed always ahead, a little closer every day. It seldom varied and yet was always different. None could tell what each new day would bring. True, our chartered craft was not always a boon, for we were required to leave it by boat, and in turn, once our boat could be concealed along some island shore, to go into the depths which displeased us. Even so, the crew grew daily more inquisitive, confident that we sought hidden treasure and likely to demand a share, so that it was difficult avoiding their questions and their ever-increasing suspicions. We sought thus for 3 months, and then 2 days ago we put down anchor off a strange uninhabited island far from any major settlement. Nothing grew upon it, and it had the appearance of blasted area. Indeed, it seemed to be but an upthrusting of basaltic rock, which at one time must have loomed high above the water, but which had been bombarded severely, possibly during the past war. Here we left our craft. We went round the island and descended into the sea. There, too, was the city of the Deep Ones, and it too had been blasted and ruined by enemy action. But though the city below the Black Island was in ruins, it was not deserted, and it stretched away on all sides into untouched areas. And there, in one of the oldest of the huge monolithic buildings, we found that which we sought. In the center of a vast room, many stories in height, lay a great stone slab, which was the source of that likeness I had first seen and failed to recognize in the decoration of my uncle's house, the seal of Relier, and standing upon it, we could hear from beneath it movement as of some vast amorphous body, restless as the sea, stirring in dream, and we knew we had come to the goal we sought, and could now enter upon an eternity of service to him who will rise again, the dweller in the deep, the sleeper in the depths, whose dreams encompass not only earth, but the dominion of all the universes, and who shall need such as Ada Marsh and I to minister to his wants until the time of his second coming. We all still here as I write, and I set this down should we fail to return to our craft. The hour is late, and tomorrow we shall descend again to find some way, if possible, to open the seal. Was it indeed imposed upon great Cthulhu by the elder gods in banishing him? And dare we then to pry it up to go below, into the presence of him who lies dreaming there? Ada and I, and soon there will be another of us, born in his natural element, to wait and serve great Cthulhu. For we have heard the call, we have obeyed, and we are not alone. There are others who come from every corner of the earth and spawn, too, of that mating between men and women of the sea. And soon the seas will belong to us, and thereafter all earth and beyond. And we shall live in power and glory forever.